My name's Ed Piskor.
I'm Jim Rugg.
And Warren Bernard came to Pittsburgh to talk comics with us and brought a special treat, Impact Comics number one. Take a look at the cover. You know what's on the inside, but this is a Jack Davis cover highlighting the most important story of the EC Comics bibliography, Master Race, drawn famously by Bernie Krigstein. Warren, thanks for bringing this baby along.
I was packing up my box of other stuff, and I was like, you know, maybe I should bring this along because I knew that you hadn't delved into any of the EC Comics, no less this one. And with exception of a handful of Mads, it's the only other one that I saved from back when I was in college.
Marie Severin did most of the color work for EC Comics. And I'm looking at this cover, and it's not traditional four-color separations. Like, there's washes in there, so I think that's pretty interesting. Maybe when it came to the glossy cover, they did some other process besides just the traditional Zipitone breakdowns.
I see in this cover is Jack Davis had to have seen this story. He had to have seen Krigstein's work to be so accurate in what he's drawing here. And even the angles and stuff feel like, you know, it's not just the characters that he's copying, but also kind of that whole tone, the visual tone.
I mean, these girders, it's a claustrophobic feeling. It goes along a lot with just the way Krigstein cut up the panels, and the characters are so tight in the panels. But it's just like he's getting boxed in. It feels almost like you know, Enter the Dragon in that mirror room or something like that, where like this dude, it's a claustrophobic setting.
Well, and also these stripes, reminiscent of the stripes that were worn by the concentration camp
genius
people, okay? So, shall we delve inside?
Yes, and we'll focus on Master Race for the most part, but in order to even accurately talk about Master Race, we've got to show like what a standard EC, you know, set of stories would look like. And traditionally what would happen is the artist would receive the pre-Leroy lettered pages with this, you know, pseudo-mechanical type all over the pages. And it's often described as an avalanche of text that guys like Feldstein would provide. Man, just if you want to flip some pages, just tons and tons of type.
Very dense.
Three tiers of panels, usually within the 6 and 9 panel grids. But lots and lots and lots of type. You could clearly tell, you know, where the squares begin and end of, like, where the panels should be. And this looks like a George Evans piece.
Yeah, it does look like a George Evans.
And, of course, EC celebrated for having the best artist of the time period and you know, being paid well and recognizing that as a trait, as almost one of their commercial traits. Krigstein had some real specific ideas, too. You know, he was very much an artist, and he was pushing against both the way these pages would be kind of pre-ruled out and structured, and also he wanted to do things with the form that just weren't being done, like expanding the page count, you know, to be able to play with time himself, like the artist be responsible rather than the writer that was putting the words on the page.
And this is his masterpiece.
Here we go.
He negotiated a couple of extra pages, which included an extra, a little bit of a longer deadline. So it is his masterpiece and not accidentally. You know, he must have recognized he had something here and really fought for the chance to make it the best it could be.
Yeah, of course, we come way later. So we don't know what's in the zeitgeist. But as we're growing up and we you know, in history class, we learn about, you know, World War II and all that. It's far too clear cut. It's like, you know, the Nazis were bad. Kill the Nazis. Like, we win the war. But there's all this messiness of, like, so many fucking Nazi soldiers and officers got away scot-free.
Right.
Many of them still hanging out, chilling in resorts in, like, Argentina.
Yeah.
And, you know, the name Simon Wiesenthal was never taught to us in school. You know, like, we had to, like, rely on the news and newspapers and stuff for that. So
Warren, I think, I'm not sure when I first heard of this story, but I know one place I saw it was when the Comics Journal did their list of top 100 comics of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
This was on there. It was written about. And so I'm curious what you knew about this comic, how it got on your radar.
And before that, like, probably the most popular place that people consumed this story before, like, we'll say the place that probably hit the tipping point for this was in the Smithsonian Book of Comic Book Art. So
right.
So it was collected in there, zillions of those things were published.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great, great point.
Well, that was after I saw this, okay? In college, I was part of the Maryland Comic Arts Society, and that's where I met Groth and Katrin, as I've said before. And there were a bunch of people there. I was like 17 or 18 when I got there, and there were a bunch of people there that were in their early to mid-20s. And so they're the ones who turned me on to EC Comics, okay? That they, you know, it was one guy there was trying to complete his set of ECs. So I got turned on to Weird Science, Weird Fantasy, and you know, I saw Shock Suspense stories. It was just my taste that I was not that much into the horror ones, but I really enjoyed the science fiction ones. And I forgot where I had been told about this, but as you can tell, I bought a copy then. I think this might have cost me $5, $10, you know, some ridiculous amount of money, okay, that, you know, back then, working on a loading dock in Montgomery Ward's at $2.20 an hour, I could afford, a comic book like this. But one, being Jewish, and two, being somewhat was a history major in college, that when I read this, there were two things. One, it was the story. It was like, well, this is not really Sergeant Rock. It's not Enemy Ace. It is not Sergeant Fury and the Howling Commandos. This is a totally different thing on one side. The other side was visually, it was unlike anything I had ever seen before. Okay? So just, and just take this panel here.
I read this, okay. I read this in that Smithsonian book when I was just a boy. I got the book at the flea market, and I'm like, what are you telling me here? And then obviously it's the speed of the train going by, and how do you communicate that?
Right.
And it's fucking genius.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, absolutely. And the angles he was taking, this almost film noirish Fritz Lang 1920s German expressionist film, Baroque view of where the angle of the perspective of the drawing was coming from, okay? And also, I was very familiar with New York. I was going up to New York all the time back during that time frame. So these images in the subway, I was very familiar with, okay? And to say it stuck with me is an understatement. As you can see, I held on to the goddamn comic book, okay? And there were other comic books I should have held on to, but I didn't. So it was like three different things occurring at the same time. One was this historical thing, one being Jewish, okay? And then the other of just the art and the way some of my knowledge of, I was very much into film noir back then, that was informing me of what was going on here artistically. And then I said, when I saw that, I was like, oh, this is going to be something really different.
Yeah, it's amazing. And Marie Severin coloring this story, I presume.
She colored most EC works, so no reason to think that she didn't color this, but he might have
called
to
mind Schindler's List, right? And the girl in the red coat.
Yeah, the girl in the red coat, yes, yeah, yeah.
The other thing, too, about this is, as you know, if you want to flip the page,
and likely something that Spielberg would have been familiar with this story. And I mean, he was a comics collector, certainly EC would be
right.
The type of comics I would assume he'd be aware of.
And especially
and an
this
iconic
story. Okay, for someone who didn't he had relatives that were Holocaust survivors, if I'm not mistaken, okay?
One more. You mentioned the angles in the noir, and I've seen people, I'm not going to take credit for this, but descending into hell, essentially, in that first panel.
Yeah,
really
interesting.
Setting the tone for what's to come.
He plays with archetypes as well, you know, the physiognomy of cartooning, where you got a certain look to a character, and this is your hero. You got a certain look to your character, and this is the bad guy. He flips it because the sort of victim, you know, the Holocaust survivor, is kind of scary looking.
Yeah,
he looks like a villain.
Yeah, a ghost, and haunted with a past.
It's Joe Average, who's the bad guy. And you just did not see that. And it, like, the bad guys and the good guys are very, very clear in comics at this time.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you come into this where all of the... This is a very film-oriented image right here, okay, where you would run a montage that was sitting in that fixed window.
And that's a is that a flashback sequence? Or
yes.
Like the people outside, right?
Yeah. You look around at your fellow passengers sitting alone in their own little worlds of fear, studying their faces, their features, their eyes, looking, always looking. What are you looking for, Carl? Who is it that you're afraid of? Okay.
And, you know, we had mentioned that this was something that Kriegstein cuts up and sort of literally cuts up the original boards and pastes these up. And you can find original scans of that artwork and see it. But I assume like stuff like this where the panel is the equivalent of the words. You know,
yes,
like,
right.
You'll see him really playing with form in a way that, again, you don't see in the other EC stories.
We should just blow the spot for like what the comic is, man, just so that we could comfortably talk about like the certain things. So this guy is a war criminal.
Right.
He's a war criminal, Nazi officer, living in New York City. Everybody around him is none the wiser. Our guy here is a survivor of the Holocaust, of the concentration camp, and recognize, like, they recognize each other. I guess it looks like he recognizes the dude getting on the train first.
Yes.
But that's the story.
Right, right. And it's also interesting because think about the role that trains played in the Holocaust.
Yes.
Okay? So that occurring in this very tight, cramped space for most of the story, well, that was the story of them being hauled off into, to Auschwitz and other such nefarious places. And you know, you see these very claustrophobic scenes right here, and then this huge scene of just all of a sudden this expanse opens up in front of you.
Yeah, and there's that sense of both of these characters have that past, and we're seeing these flashbacks, and who knows which character's point of view we're seeing.
Right, exactly.
Some of these flashbacks.
Yeah. And by the way, that was one of the things when I read it the first time, when I got to that end page, I was like, oh, that's not what I was expecting, okay? The whole thing had flipped, okay? And so with all those elements, like, okay, I gotta get a copy of this. So
just like when you see, you know, what are crazy eyes? Like when you could see the white around three
right.
sides of the eyeballs. So you got all these hypnotized German
right.
citizens.
Right there.
For sure. And just speaking more to the claustrophobia, you know, like let the panel borders cut, you know, every side of your character off, man. It's going to feel real tight around them.
Right, right. No, and like I said, the because you're in that confined space of a subway car in New York, it added a lot to what was going on here.
You would never see like these kind of establishing shots from something that was like not character oriented, or if you did, like the payoff would be that I guess it does fit in line with EC Comics, as we will see on the last page.
Ready?
Yeah, let's do it.
And then to see this panel in any comic book, okay, making this overt historical political statement all at the same time, was just something that had just thoroughly frosted my head, okay?
This is a new direction title. So Frederick Wortham has happened.
Right.
The Senate subcommittees have happened. EC Comics can no longer be the EC Comics of Tales from the Crypt and Weird Science and Shocking Suspense Stories and Crab Suspense Stories. This is what they called the new direction titles. The artists were fucking embarrassed. Like, imagine you're just a comic artist and you're watching the news and seeing people burn comics
yeah.
and you're being called a heathen and, you know, a corrupter of minors and things. From the rubble of that comes this,
yeah.
where it's like the artists are meeting that challenge. Like, oh, you don't think we could do more mature works? Like, we'll give you the most mature work of the day. Like,
right.
what's the next mature piece to come? Like something from the underground? Like, you know, Binky Brown? You know, like, what is next after this?
Well, yeah, and you raise a good point that they were like, if you think about the approach that Feldstein and Gaines were taking, was that, you know, they were trying to, you know, gear their stuff towards adults.
Right.
Okay? Well, when they took the thrill factors out, because they were going for a very low end of engaging the adults, when all of a sudden you put the intelligence into it, all right, and in terms of trying to engage the adults, that this was, to me, years ahead of its time in that respect, in that it was trying to go ahead and grab people on the level of, well, I'll go ahead and say it, Mouse, all right?
I always make that association with Krigstein's imagery in general, his line work. It always feels like it was an older, a more mature, sophisticated, contemporary, you know, mid-century modern style.
This is the artwork of a Time or Life magazine illustrator right here.
Yeah. Or a Dan Clowes, you know, right. Obviously a big influence on him. Ed, you mentioned the comic book burning and, you know, these guys sort of like post-Frederick Wortham, and you see the critical, like, you know, let's not side with them just yet. Like, look at what book burning, where it comes from.
Right.
And this whole page, like, I think of the people on the street that are covering their faces, like walking by the walls.
And
you know, where it's like the regular people, like everybody's culpable here.
Well, and a number of years ago, I went to Berlin, and my friends took me. We went up north, and we went to the Ravensbrück concentration camp. That was the women's camp, and they had a crematorium there. And there was also a part there that was owned by Siemens, okay, the big electronics firm. So they're using slave labor. And it sat on a lake. And when you stood at Ravensbrück on the lake, you could see the town across the lake. And myself and my friend's husband were like, how could they not have known? I mean, what was it that they weren't getting, okay? And so this one, you're right, okay? And it was very real. And you know, even bringing in the experiments that they were doing. I mean, what's interesting about this is they pulled no punches, okay?
When did this come out? Is it under a decade? Since this is April, March, April
of 1955.
It's about 10 years.
Yeah, it's a decade. Okay. But the level of adultness in this story is not to be underestimated. And there are people today that still don't quite reach this level of presentation. Okay.
Right.
There are a lot of people today that don't reach this level of presentation.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about, like, people who are like a Joe Kubert fax from Sarajevo or something that gets reduced to just another issue of Sergeant Rock at a certain point or something. Like,
right.
This is another level.
Right. All right. And of course, so many of you also have to think back to 1955 that there were, so someone who was 20, okay, in 1955 was 10. Now, they may not have been conscious, but they went through the war, so they knew what the war was about because everyone had to make the sacrifices on the home front. So a vast number of people that read this comic book, all right, had some memory, because they would have been intense, of what happened during the war. Okay, so this also, it's not an abstraction because I'm not saying Mouse is an abstraction, but a lot of the people who were reading Mouse weren't around during World War II. Not take anything away from it in any way, shape, or form. But the people who are reading this, almost everybody that was reading this, was around during the war.
Every time I look at this story, I try to imagine context, and I even try to imagine what Krigstein is seeing. And we look at the survivor of the concentration camp, very bony face, emaciated guy, kind of guy, and it makes me wonder if the people, the survivors that made it to New York, that maybe Krigstein would bump into, like, from PTSD even, or just you know, slowly getting their faculties back together or whatever, like, were a lot of the survivors that came to America, did they have these kind of, like, gaunt features or something like that? Like, those are thoughts that come into my mind.
Yeah, imagine what he's going for.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
To represent that pain of, like, a survivor's guilt or whatever.
Sure, right, yeah.
You know, how do you do that in an illustration?
Right, but does it have, like, real-life counterparts to it? Like, does he know somebody that...
Yeah, that would be... Well, of course, you know, if he was in New York... Now, with a name like Krigstein, I wonder what his background was and whether or not... he had relatives in Europe at the time. It doesn't matter which side.
Right.
Okay. Because both sides, of course, got impacted by it. So I'd be curious to learn more about Krigstein's family background.
Yeah, I would bet. I mean, most people, you know, I'm sure Jack Davis, like, was a corn-fed, multi-generational American.
Right.
But you know, almost everybody else, you know, their grandparents, their came grandparents over, came if, over. If not, right. not great grandparents
or parents, okay,
and, parents. That's yeah, what, yeah,
because and all those guys, and you know, also think about the impact on the Jack Kirby. I wonder what happened when if Kirby ever read this, okay, or any of the other people who were or Siegel and Shuster, whoever else was around, who had Jewish relatives, okay.
Wonder what Kurtzman would have thought of this.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
because Kurtzman was, like, trying to punch to this kind of territory in the war books. And the war books, as units, are, the best EC comic books that you know, money can buy. Right. But none of those stories, for all of their virtues and sort of, like, anti-war message and stuff, doesn't hit this.
Right.
This is the pinnacle.
Yeah, like I said, so... This so struck me when I was like 20 years old, okay? And I'm glad that you guys are doing this is an understatement. Shall we turn the page? I mean, anything yes. else you want to... Because it is interesting because they have him with, you know, ransacking the Jewish stores. And this is actually... There's a photograph that's almost just like this, okay? But then here, they're also in a Christian home. Right, to show that, and it was true.
I think specifically Catholic was a big no-go, right? So that kind of imagery is you would see in a Catholic house for sure.
Right, and you know the reds of the Nazi flags and
the reds are important in this story.
Yes, but also the color palette and the way they went ahead and just put this grayness into the concentration camp.
That's him. That's Zipitone. So he's in charge of the Zips.
I'm happy to hear both of you point out color again because it does stand out to me. We see so much terrible color in comics. Like, that helps a lot. You know, you take a story that's really risen to the challenge and put shitty coloring on it, you can do a lot of damage. I hope this is Marie Severin.
Right.
you know, in my mind, you know, that's who it is because that's who I associate with it. But it's so well done, the coloring, and it really does help the art. You know, it accentuates where it should and stands out. It is a lot of ghastly images. Those light blues and gray colors.
Yeah.
Not typical of you know, what we think of as four color funnies and stuff. Pretty unusual coloring that goes with this story.
Now of course the other interesting thing about this is here within 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, within 12 panels, he basically tells the story of what happened to the Jews and other people during the Holocaust. 12 panels. All right, and does it remarkably effectively. From just the starting of the burning of the books to just hustling people off and going in, then all of a sudden it gets worse and worse and worse and worse and then can't get no worse.
You do think of things like cancel culture, right? Which obviously we're living in this time period now, and then giving rise to these totalitarian response to, you know, like they go hand in hand. They beget each other regardless of what the intent is. That censoring, it's happened many times in history.
Right. And actually, on the cancel culture, what I tell people to do is look at the Red Guard in the Great Leap Forward. I'm sorry, the Cultural Revolution in China in the mid-1960s. If you look at what the Red Guard was doing, what's happening with some, maybe not all, of the cancel culture. It's almost identical in terms of the totalitarian nature of it. So, no, I won't find disagreement here, okay? Yeah, the revenge. Someday I'll get you.
Yeah, and that's our guy. That's our survivor.
Right.
In the midst of his turmoil.
Yeah, and then where it all of a sudden...
The recognition.
Okay. It's like, no.
Gott in Himmel.
That's an amazing panel for body language because there's so little that we see.
Yeah,
but
right.
You see the hunching
right.
back of like, please don't. He looks so tense behind
right.
that paper.
The eye. Okay. Yeah.
That's amazing. I think of like body language, you know, and how much you communicate, but like there's almost nothing to work with there and it still comes across as that hunched up tense figure.
And the pleading right here. Yeah, I mean, and these two pages, just in terms of the emotion between the two.
As, you know, Krigstein is working in black and white, and so just like cartooning shorthand of just like the black character of our survivor, and then, you know, the light color of the bad guy, One, that turns things on, because usually black you associate with villainous. But two, just as cartooning 101, like he's keeping everything clear, because perhaps he even knows he's getting claustrophobic and tight. You don't want to mix just the simple illustrations up.
Yeah, right, so much more powerful with that simple choice.
Right, and then you know, that first time I read it and I got to this, was like, okay, that's exactly the opposite of where I thought this thing was going. All right.
Based on the look of the characters?
Based on the look of the characters, yeah. Because, you know, because you're programmed, or at least, you know, when I was 19 or 20 years old, I was programmed that the guy in black is the bad guy, and then, you know, whoever's not in black is not the bad guy, okay? And also, if you look at the way everything is structured in terms of the text and the word balloons, you can't tell, right? So it's ambiguous about who's really remembering what and what the context was of that remembering, and you don't get it until here.
This is quite a disturbing imagery, you know, the background of this panel. One more thought on the guy in black is, he's death.
Totally.
You know,
he's death come to
this guy, but he's also, in a way, he's already dead. You know, like he's already lost what he's about to take from this guy.
Well, and also anyone who went through that, they had, you know, they had a certain amount of death brought to them on a whole bunch of different levels. So a lot of those people came out of that emotionally dead. Physical death to relatives and things like that, and then what they saw and the impact of what it was that they saw. So,
yeah, and then they start going through the railroad, the train station. And I'm sorry, I love this.
Yeah, it's a ghost, man. It's a ghost coming after him.
Well, also that all of a sudden they've taken everybody else out of the train platform. There's no one else there. It's just the two of them. And you know as well as I do, on a practical basis in New York in a subway, that's only going to happen if you're like, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning on some obscure station. So this was the other thing, that all of a sudden, they turned it into, it's just the two of them.
Yeah, it's an opera.
Right. It's an opera. Yeah, look at this. Have pity. Really? After all the shit you want? Yeah. Really? So, ready? And then, the killer last page.
Boom.
Right.
Klaus, Frank Miller, storytelling.
Yeah.
So many people, man.
Just all of this. Just this whole thing. These panels right there. When, like I said, when I first read this, I was like, oh, I didn't know comics could do that.
Right. Yeah, some of that motion time in the panel stuff. It's phenomenal. I would add Will Eisner to that list of artists, and it makes me wonder, are either of those guys influencing each other, or are they just sort of figuring out, you know, the same conclusions on their own?
Sure. Yeah.
Because, I mean, obviously masters of comic storytelling, but you see it all on that page, especially those first two tiers as the dancing figure, the movement.
This is a bookending sequence to go with panel one, and then the guy, like, walks off into the black abyss, you know? You just see hands, you see the head, like... He sort of accomplished this goal, this revenge thing, but you get no sense that anything good is going to come from that. And that's something you would never see in comics. It was always a very clear, like, you destroy the bad guy and, like, all is well with the world.
Yeah.
That's not the truth. This is...
Right.
This is only bittersweet. Like, the entire... Yeah. There's never a second of, like, levity or a place to catch a breath.
Yeah, right. It's all Batman bad. Or the Punisher at the end.
Right. It's all
feeling
bad.
Good.
And also, so all of us, now also think about the timing of all of this, okay? Is that back here, you have them running down the platform, and it's empty, okay? And he trips and, of course, gets smushed. And then all of a sudden, people arrive. All right, so this whole sequence happens, and I can only presume that a train came from the other side of the platform and disembarked.
Or that's...
Okay.
Right, yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
All right, at the time he was killed. And so, but yeah, so if anyone wants to study comics, just these two rows right here, stare at it a lot,
I mean, this exactly right here, the Frank Miller piece, is when they're standing on those, like, the phone lines. And then, I forget who it is, somebody jumps up and jumps down. And then you see Elektra or Bullseye or somebody. Like, it's the same poses.
Yeah. A tour de force, it was the most adult thing in comics for decades.
Yeah, all of this was filibuster for me to try to figure out what would be the next kind of paradigm shifting. You know, maybe did Jules Pfeiffer do something important in between then? Like,
he did a bunch of, you know, Tantrum. So the year that Contract with God came out, Tantrum also came out. Tantrum is much more of a true graphic novel than Contract with God.
Right.
Okay. That if you read the both of them, you go, well, this is just a bunch of Sholem Aleichem short stories, and Tantrum was a bona fide graphic novel, but Eisner's remembered for this graphic novel thing, and because Jules was going after this totally different audience, he's kind of left out of that conversation.
Yeah, he's left out of cartooning conversations much, period.
Don't get me started. Just don't get me started. A genuine tragedy. But anyway, like I said, I here we are now, what, 65 years after this was done, and I can't think of a comic even 30 years after this one that did what this did.
Yeah. I invite people in the comments to just like name names, because there might be an obvious something that we're leaving off.
Right.
But it ain't Sergeant Rock.
Right. No, it's not Sergeant Fury, for that matter, okay?
Certainly not.
But and also when you take it about, it's not just the subject matter, but then the presentation of the subject matter and the radical way in which it was done. And if you put the two of them together, there's a historical argument to be made that nothing of this caliber has been done since then. Okay. And I'll send the challenge out.
Right.
Okay. If someone thinks that there has been some level of nonfiction that has had the influence that this has had since then, I'm all ears. Okay.
Right. From the Silver Age, there are these all-star cartoonists, and we have the conversation very often. We've done videos. Alex Toth, what's the masterpiece? Nobody could put their finger on it. Consensus agreement, for the most part, Master Race is Bernie Krigstein's masterpiece comic strip.
Yeah, right. And one that has, by the way, so I read it when I was 20, and when I got it back out of the box, I hadn't read it in, you know, decades, and I read it again. I was like, this is really fucking good, okay? It was so there's this thing that I do this with movies that I saw when I was a kid, and some of them, like for instance, the original Planet of the Apes, okay? I saw it as a kid, and I was like, wow, that was really good, and I saw it again as an adult, I was like, wow, that was really good, all right? But there have been other films where it was like, oh my God, what was I thinking,
sure.
Okay? This is one of those ones that, even though I have aged, okay, the impact of this has not lessened.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like there's anything embarrassing or even beyond that. Yeah, something clumsy, you know, like so many stories often with comics, they don't age perfectly because the vernacular changes so much and things just don't...
Right.
You know, they have dated elements, for example.
Yeah, sure.
This doesn't feel like it has anything that you would point at and be like, well, this is unfortunate,
or
this is a little bit embarrassing, or they could have done it better. It feels like the efficiency with which the story is told, it's just everybody really nails it. You know, we pointed out coloring a couple of times. That's one of those places where you often see comics drop the ball.
Yeah.
Pretty exemplary. Yeah.
Not here at all. And again, the impact of the story, not only from what the story is, but then also the influence of, you were talking about, you know, people ripping off, you know, all of this stuff. So if there's an equal story out there from somebody else, I'd like to know.
I know you've had a lot of associations with Spiegelman over the years. Did you ever talk to him about
I've never talked to him about a Master Race, no.
He has. I feel like he has written about this story, though, right? I mean, like, he's pretty much on record talking about it. You couldn't do Mouse without being, you know, asked by Gary Groff and Comic Book Nerds, certainly, about it. But I feel like he's, you can find writing and commentary from him.
I just can't recall any. And I'm curious how he would speak to the...
Yeah, and by the way, I don't want to take anything away from Mouse. Mouse was, as that was coming out, that was equally amazing, but it's different.
Oh, definitely.
Okay, you know, it's really different. That's I shouldn't say fictionalized, but because of the artistic metaphors that are in it, it's a very different presentation. So it's kind of like comparing Da Vinci with Picasso, right? They're both great artists. Okay, I'm not going to argue with either one of them, but you know, there's no way to go ahead and make a value judgment about which one is better or more influential,
yeah, for sure,
or what have you. So,
and even the artistic choice of the end is askew and cut up.
Yeah. Yeah. And also walking off into the darkness, okay.
And you get no sense. Like, that's what I mean. It's just, this guy ain't okay. Like, this guy did accomplish his mission as something that he was probably in the back of his mind for that decade since he got out. And
right.
He's not changed.
Yeah,
right.
You almost think of the EC twist would be like, he should feel good, and the fact that he doesn't feel good at
all.
Yes,
right.
He might
yeah,
even
yeah.
feel worse.
Yeah. So, all right, well.
That's a heavy one.
Yeah, but it had to be done, and I'm really glad you wanted to go ahead and do this.
We were going to do Master Race at some point, man, but you got an OG copy of Impact Comics, and you know, three heads are better than one when it comes to a comic like this.
So glad we got together and do this. This is just great. So
let's plan more videos.
I think we can do that.
All right, let's get out of here, man. Kayfabers, like, follow, subscribe to the YouTube channel. Hit the bell icon. We can notify you when new videos are available. And doing so mitigates the kayfabe effect. When we talk about comics, they seem to become worth more money the next day, man. So you want to get in on the ground floor.
Oh, by the way, I am not selling this.
Right.
You can subscribe to the Cartoonist Kayfabe e-newsletter at the links below this video. You can find Cartoonist Kayfabe merchandise and t-shirts at the links below this video.
Let's get the hell out of here. Check that out, man. Give them the marching orders.
Read more comics.